From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 281, recorded live Thursday, September 1st, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, the first in a series on startups, Scott talks with Gabriel Weinberg about his new search engine, DuckDuckGo.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today, just because I decided at this very moment, it's the first episode of our startup series. And I'm talking to Gabriel Weinberg, founder of DuckDuckGo. How's it going, sir?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I looked on your blog and did some research on you, and you are an overnight success that took about 15 years.
You could say something like that.
You have this great blog post that it might even be like your most popular, that is a list of all of your successes and failures. What's the ratio, typically, you think, of people who are in the startup space? How many times do you have to fail before you actually hit it?
That is an interesting question. And I've also failed in different types of ways, like do something for a week or a month or even years. And so I don't know, but I think failure shapes you in a good way. And so, I mean, that's why I wrote that post, is to get out there that failing is okay. And I actually, the other approach that I like to take to it is have a career path as your have a startup career path. And so if you think about startups as a career path, it takes you a while to learn how to do it. And what you don't want is to have the one and done attitude where you give it one shot and it fails and then you're back to your job, because that almost never works. So I don't know how many times you have to fail to make it successful, but I know you're generally not successful on the first shot.
See, that's a really interesting, that just like clicked something in my brain. Like, take like two people, both 20 years old, both coming out of college. One goes to work at Aflac Insurance. The other one goes and does a startup. It's always expected that the startup guy is either going to succeed or fail. And then after, if he fails, he'll just, he'll work at Jack in the Box the rest of his life. But you never hear about like the guy at Aflac saying, yeah, I went in there and I kicked this job's butt. Now I'm 22 and I'm a VP. It's always understood that the Aflac guy is going to have to work for 20 years. Why is there a myth of that a startup somehow is something that you go out there and you nail it and you knock it out of the park, as opposed to taking 20 years, apprenticing and journeyman and all that kind of stuff?
Exactly. And there are paths to do that, right? So the apprentice journeyman thing is you can be the, first employee at a startup. Another thing I did, which is do consulting on the side, but really restrict it to only working 4 hours a day. I upped my rate a bit, but I was living very frugally, but I could focus most of the day on startup stuff. Consulting, web consulting is great for that, because you can really limit it to hours like that.
I've always been afraid to do a startup after I got married and had kids, because, and I'm always fascinated in the like day-to-day, how did you live part of it. Like, you've got kids, but you've also got a pile of startups and ideas and failed deployments kind of under your, in your experience bag. Was it like, did you get married and say, all right, this is what we're going to do. We're going to live frugally. This is my career. My career is going to be a series of failures, but if you stick with me, I'm going to nail one or two.
Yeah, I was lucky in that the success happened before we had kids, though. And I think I could see it being a lot more difficult if you try to start after you have kids, right? But my spouse also works, has a great job, and so that also helps as well. I think it becomes a lot easier, right, in your college example, if you start right out of college, because you don't have kids then usually. And that's what I did. I started right out of college. And then once you're, it took me 6 years or so, or six or seven before there was a success, but I was still only, 26, 27. And we didn't have kids yet, but there's a lot of years in your 20s. In other words, right. What I'm saying,
but presumably you weren't discouraged at this point.
No, I was not discouraged.
So it sounds like you had a practical idea that, okay, this is going to take a while. This is a slog. It's not going to be like Facebook.
Yeah, although, honestly, it wasn't as thought out a plan as you're making it to be. when I graduated school, I just decided I wanted to do it, and I did it, and I wasn't thinking about success or failure, and the first failure really hit me hard, actually. And that's when I had put everything into it. I raised some friends and family money. I lost that. And that's when I sort of regrouped and slowly got back into it doing consulting. And just did it again because that's what I liked and wanted to do. I didn't necessarily, wasn't thinking I'm going to do it for X years. And if I'm not successful, I'll switch. You know what I mean? I just sort of kept going.
That's interesting that with the benefit of hindsight, I think that anyone with some measure of success then eventually gets asked by some, you know, young upstart, like, oh, how can I have your success? And when you tell the story backwards of how it went down, it could look like it's a master plan. And even though you tell them, well, there was no plan. I had no idea. I mean, we had like, there's like three guys and a futon and there was a keg and now there's a startup. But in retrospect, it always seems magical. I mean, I have people tell me like, you know, how do you get into media? How do you do blogging? How do you go work for Microsoft? And I tell them the story about how I fell into a community college and I was supposed to meet a buddy there and he never showed up and I enrolled in the computer science program and that's what happened, you know, and it's like disappeared. They don't believe it though. They don't believe that there was no plan at all. None of this was planned, but it could be a recipe of success if you follow it exactly, I suppose.
I believe a lot in the, who was it, was it Woody Allen, 90% is showing up or something like that?
Yeah.
I believe a lot in that. And with startups in particular, there's a lot involved in timing. And so if you're around for a while doing something, often your time comes if you're not, you know, 15 years early. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I sort of believe in general in life, if you're super persistent and you just work at it, and the same thing is true with blogging, as I've learned in the last couple of years, you know, eventually it generally works out.
I listened to this really great interview with Mark Maron, who's a comedian who started a podcast, and his time has never come. And that's kind of like the angsty thing about his podcast. It's basically him interviewing his famous friends, and he's the one guy who just it never happened for. And he interviewed Paul Reiser, the American comedian and sitcom star. And Paul Reiser was talking about how One day he was like, I think he was like 19 or 20, and he went up to Peter Falk, who played Columbo, and he said, hey, I really want to write a script. You wrote this great script. How do you write a script? And Peter Falk said, well, you put some paper in a typewriter, and you type fade in, and you keep typing. And he was like, wow. And he never like absorbed it quite like that. But so many people who fail just simply don't finish. So it was interesting when I looked at your list, you were pretty hard on yourself. You were basically saying, here was a great project, here was a great project, this didn't work out, that didn't work out. But I'm reading into it a little bit, but it seemed like the ones that you regretted were the ones that you never even deployed. Like they exist and only on your hard drive.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you have to put yourself out there for things to be successful. You know, it's like the first thing you have to do. And a lot of people don't get to that point and they're just shooting themselves in the foot, as was I, you know, on those projects.
Mm-hmm. I did a post recently about being a phony and the idea of the imposter syndrome. And that resonated with me vis-a-vis your list of failures. It seems like when people talk about that stuff openly, like everyone comes out of the woodwork, like with your posts that you wrote about all the failures. I was like, wow, you mean you didn't just invent DuckDuckGo like out of nowhere and had no experience failing at all?
Yeah, I saw your post too and liked it. And I agree. They really bring people out of the woodwork. And I wrote this other post recently about blogging because I committed to blogging a couple years ago. And mm-hmm. It was the first time I had started lots of blogs and failed at them. And then this time I would just, like your typewriter example, I said I'm going to commit. I'm just going to write 100 posts in 2010 and try to make them quality posts, you know, and whatever happens, happen. And, you know, worked well. And in 2011, I've slowed down the pace but done longer things. But it was basically just writing, you know, spending the time to write stuff down. But with the with this commitment post about blogging, I was thinking in retrospect, it's like there's so little of these posts, and they're so impactful for people. I don't know why people don't more write about stuff in the trenches. You know, people just want to write when they're successful and say, look here, I was successful. But they, even at those times, they don't like to write and reveal exactly why they think they were successful and all the numbers behind it. But people love reading it. You know, I think if there's a shortcut to blogging, there's an underutilized, there's an area of posts that is completely underutilized, and that's it. If you're a startup, you could go out and start writing all that stuff down, and I think people would eat it up.
Yeah, I totally agree. One of the websites that I read a lot of is Marco Arment, the creator of Instapaper, and I think he worked at Tumblr. And what's great about his blog is he talks about like the actual stats, like, you know, I'm thinking about removing support for this version of iOS, and here's how I am making my decision. It's like detailed statistical analysis about what I'm going to do before he does it. So rather than a post about I did this and it worked out great and aren't I awesome, it's almost like him musing, like, when am I going to drop support for 3? When am I going to, well, I could do this, I could do that. And that makes the success not seem like it is just simply, gratis and just happens for him. You can see that, there's work involved in doing this. And I'm surprised that so many people, not just in their startup work, but in any work at all, try to keep things a secret. Maybe they're afraid of being judged, or maybe they're concerned that we're going to look down on them, but say what you're working on and the decisions behind it and how it makes you feel. There's like less honesty in blogging now, you know?
And I think it is related to the fear of kind of rejection and criticism. Mm-hmm. And I think that's legitimate. You know, people, almost every post I write that gets submitted somewhere, you know, you read the comments, a lot of them, you know, people are critical in general on the web, but yeah, you have to get over that. You know, it reminds me a lot about public speaking and the fear there, which is a valid fear, but it just, I think everyone would be better off, especially in the startup world, because startups involve risk. If you got over those fears, you know, it would help you.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about DuckDuckGo, because I think there's a couple interesting things as I again read into patterns in your list of failed projects, as you actually come up to one that's very successful, is that in each of your projects you say, well, this is essentially this, or this is essentially that. I wrote this and it was kind of like posturous. And I'm curious, are your projects that you compare to successful projects, the ones that you failed on, that you compare to successful ones, were they first or were they similar? Because DuckDuckGo is essentially Google, but then essentially not at all in ways that you'll tell us. But you've done several other projects that you compare to ones that we've heard of.
All the other ones that I compared to were pretty much first, and I was too early. And part of the failure there was, like I was saying before, is just not staying around long enough, you know? Taking the site down when it wasn't successful, not, you know, A/B testing enough. Some of those were too niche. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they were generally first, and DuckDuckGo was obviously, you know, way late to the search engine market, but offering a different approach to it. And then my last company, that the other one successful, was sort of in the middle. It was just sort of a weird company. It was closest thing you compare it to was Classmates. .com who bought it eventually, but mm-hmm. when we started out, it didn't look like that at all. I mean, that's eventually where we ended up, but it was just sort of on its own.
It's funny how those kind of things happen. So when did you have, like, when were you just sitting around and had the audacity to say, you know, not so much with the Google, let's do our own thing?
You know, so both, one reason why there's so many lists of projects is, the second and third time I was really trying to start a company, I started a bunch of different projects and then worked on them all at the same time and let them flow. And then eventually, you know, picked one. I mean, I was lucky enough that one sort of ended up being successful and I could focus on that. Mm-hmm. And so most of those just started out as side projects or just things I was interested in. And so the DuckDuckGo in particular started out this, side project. It was two different side projects, actually. So at the end of 2007, I had taken the stained glass class, and I was unhappy with the Google links that it was returning when you typed in stained glass. They weren't very relevant, and they were very commercially oriented. And, you know, in particular, the person who run the class had given us a different set of links, and they were more in line with the links that on Wikipedia's external links and Delicious was giving at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought was twofold. One, is there a way to get rid of all the SEO park domain, useless domain crap out of Google? And two, is there a way to use, you know, these other curated sites like Wikipedia and Delicious to make better results? And so my side project was mashing up Wikipedia and Delicious and just seeing what came up when you typed in results, and I did that over a weekend. And then the other side project was, if I start crawling the web, can I identify some of these spam sites? So I did those in parallel as just two projects, and then I liked the results on both, and I decided just to, you know, put them together and try to come up with something to launch. And so that's how it got really, it was born. But I wasn't set out trying to make a general search engine.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools on the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, TeamPulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying Agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself, get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/TeamPulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us. So if I understand correctly, you're saying that you, this is going to sound like a softball question, but I literally, when I was developing it in my mind, it sounded like the right thing to say. But I'm thinking to myself, you're saying that you actually care about the results that are coming out of your search engine. Like, I mean, like when someone types in stained glass, you would like your search engine to return the kinds of things that an expert in stained glass would like you to know, as opposed to what 10 million people who want to sell you stained glass would like you to know.
Exactly. And initially, one of the approaches I had was actually something that Mahalo and Squidoo, I guess, tried to do a bit, which was find experts, you know, and get them to tell you those links, you know? Or use experts like from Delicious and stuff. But the expert notion, managing your own community ends up being difficult for a lot of reasons. And so I got away from that a bit. But yeah, we care very deeply about the search results. I mean, that's the basic premise.
Well, Mahalo was like, they were trying to basically crowdsource Google. They're like a combination of Wikipedia and crowdsourcing and say, let's find a bunch of really smart people and they'll go and they'll write and they'll do like kind of a long tail thing, right? Like the long tail is not as important, but the main stuff people are searching for, we can find smart people to go and write those results and curate those links. But it never really took off. I mean, it's out there and I'm sure there are people who are obsessed with it, but I haven't even thought about it in the last year until you just said it.
Yeah, so they obviously also not pivoted. I mean, it's the startup term for changing their direction recently. And now they're doing how-to videos, sort of high-quality how-to videos. But yeah, I mean, it didn't really take off. And there were other ones like that. So, you know, mm-hmm. the original Yahoo directory was sort of like that,
right.
Except Yahoo did it internally. And then DMoz, the Open Directory project, if you remember that, mm-hmm. which is still around but very spam-ridden at this point, tried to do that in an open source way and have editors appointed for various topics. But both of those became very hard to manage and eventually were littered with, you know, expired and irrelevant links that have changed hands. You know, people weren't paying enough attention to it.
So are your links curated? I mean, is there a human out there?
We ended up, so right now we're sort of a hybrid and we do a couple things differently. So we are drawing on deep search results, generally mm-hmm. from other search engines. So we have a bunch of indexes on top of them that remove spam and rearrange them and try to get more along the lines of what we're talking about. But mm-hmm. then we have our own indexes that that we often put on top of those results. And some of those are links, you know, for like originally, like I said, from Wikipedia external links, that's one of the sources. And there's, you know, about 50 others. And then some of them we put on top of the results. And that's the most visible difference, where we put this red box on top that I call zero click info, where if you search for something like a general topic, often you'll get this red box that defines it. And that's also from a source like Wikipedia. And that's that portion is curated. So it's a hybrid.
So I just ego searched for myself, and I got it's a red box at the top with a picture of my face, which is creepy. Thank you. And it says Scott Hanselman is affiliated with Microsoft, more at Crunchbase, and then it actually tells you the last two places that I worked. And then it actually has my blog with a link that says official site, so I'm verified. I feel very excited about that. So you somehow, someone or some machine somehow has figured out that that's really me.
Yes, and all that part is curated. And then that Twitter, then it shows your Twitter, that those links that look different, you know, see how they don't have snippets. No one else can see this, but maybe they can search for you on the site.
Yeah, I think they will.
Those are more curated links that I'm talking about.
So it's got my Twitter, and then this is interesting. It's actually got Facebook and LinkedIn and Quora, and it somehow has collected all of the me's, my social identity, all over the place.
Yeah, so part of our approach is that when you search something on Google, generally there's a place out there that gives much better results than the algorithmic results. And part of our job is to do that ourselves, but what we've become, or what we're trying to become, is a recognition that there are tons of other engines and data sources that do very well at certain searches, and we want to bring those in, you know?
Yeah.
So in this case, Crunchbase does a good job, so we want to put that on top. But this Twitter case is an API example. This is actually using Qwerly, Qwerly.com, and they have an API that associates Twitter handles with all your other stuff.
Wow.
And so when we know that it's your Twitter, so we put that on top, then we recognize it's a Twitter link, and so we go out in real time and call their API and then add in all these icons for you.
And you do this in real time. What if they're not as popular as you are, and suddenly you have this relationship with Qwerly, which of course, and I can't see that relationship from this link, but you're now querying them. You have a dependency on them.
Yes. And so generally for topical stuff, there's multiple parties we could work with. For something like Qwerly, if it fell apart for some reason, we'd lose this nice feature, but it wouldn't be the end of the world, you know? And there are other replacements for it, but we haven't had that kind of issue yet.
And the thing, when I said the word audacity before, the idea that the player in your space is so huge, does that make it either more difficult or less difficult to enter the space? Because like some people might say, well, who do you think you are? I mean, freaking Google, right? I mean, you're going up against Skynet.
So generally, if there's a huge player in the space, I think it's good for you because it means there's a huge market and you know, you can generally form a niche within it and get some people to switch to you. And they validated it. And also, people don't like, other entrepreneurs often don't go for it because they're scared of it. In the Google case, it gets a little more complicated because Google is so entrenched in people's mind with search. They have such a far and away monopoly that it's hard to get people to switch. But that didn't bother me. It didn't bother me too much in the sense that I know that there are niches within. I believe that people do prefer different search engines in the same way they prefer different web browsers. And, you know, we'll be able to find our niche. And I mean, we are starting to now, but I think it's a bigger percentage of people.
As I'm scrolling down, I'm just using I'm not a complete egomaniac, but I'm using my ego search as an example because I know what I get when I search for myself elsewhere. I'm scrolling down and I'm noticing that it's like attractive. It's a pleasant looking series of results. There's like favorite icons on the side. Occasionally my smiling face will show up. Then I get down here and I see a link and it says results by Bing alongside something. So it sounds like you have relationships maybe with other search engines.
Yeah, so that's that hybrid piece where for deep results, we also use a bunch of other search engines in sort of a meta way. And then we If you compare the two, you'll notice they're a lot different generally, but
yeah,
that's
very.
Because we, you know, rearrange everything and, you know, change things around. But, some of those search engines that we use have branding requirements.
Oh, I see.
And so that's why we have a Bing and Yahoo logo there.
Does that mean that the result that is next to that logo is the one, or does
no,
that mean that it's interleaved?
Yeah, it's interleaved. I just took the approach to, we probably don't have to do it that, we probably don't have to put it there or that prominently, but I took the approach to just put it.
Oh, it's very nice to give people their props, I guess.
Yeah, and then there's a bunch of others listed in the FAQ page.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we use, you know, Bing and Yahoo, including we use a startup search engine, mm-hmm. Lecosum and EntireWeb, and you know, then we use other APIs like the Quirly one, but also things like Wolfram Alpha.
So how much of this is you, and how much of this is like before Google, and this is dating myself as being astonishingly old, but I used Metacrawler, and
yep.
Like there was a time there, like maybe about a year, where I was like, man, there was nothing else on the web except Metacrawler, and it was the crawler that crawled the other crawlers. How much are you a Metacrawler? Like what percentage of the pie chart is you and your results, and you just being smart about using other people's results?
Right. So it's a little hard to tease out because what we want to do is for about 80% of the searches have that red box and curated links on top.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest will be using other people. But mm-hmm. people click the vast majority of times on the top stuff.
Really?
And they often don't even look or click on anything below the top three. And so if you count, you know, and we have infinite scrolling, right? So if you
I just noticed that actually.
You get more results. So if you count like all the things below,
right?
You might say, "Oh, we use a lot of other people's results." But if you think about that, this our stuff is generally on top, then it's often the majority of stuff is ours. So it's hard to say, but that's why I just say we're a hybrid.
All right. I love that you have infinite scrolling though, because I'm in this epic battle right now with the Scott toilet paper people. You got to be the first Scott on Google, because there's this joke that, you know, if you're not on the first page of Google, then you're just not on the internet. The second page doesn't even exist, but with
exactly.
infinite scrolling, it does.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, it still doesn't exist much.
Yeah. I hear you. If you don't mind my asking some technical questions,
sure.
Help me understand, like, what is this built in? I mean, the idea of indexing the web or indexing anything that big, it seems really overwhelming.
Right. So, because of the hybrid approach, we don't index like crazy and use a lot of storage, because we can compress our stuff down to pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
But we do a lot of crawling, and we do have our indexes. And so most of the code is actually written in Perl language-wise.
Wow.
For database stuff, we use a bunch of different data stores depending on the source. So we have some in Solr, the Lucene-based search engine. We have some in Postgres, the database. And then we have mm-hmm. some in flat file formats. A lot in this sort of esoteric format called CDB,
mm-hmm.
Which is a read-only database format that's optimized for speed. But those are the main stores. And then we use Nginx for the web server with Memcache, and we run everything on EC2 now.
Oh, okay. So when I'm hitting DuckDuckGo, I'm hitting the web server and everything's being served through EC2.
Yep.
So you sit on top of Amazon.
Yep.
And what does success look like? Like, is this a boutique? Like, sometimes startup people will say they want to start a boutique, and that just means I want a company that will support me as I do my other stuff. Or is there an exit where Google like calls you and they're like, we give up. You're awesome. Let's work something out.
Well, the search market itself is very, very lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so, my argument is that our approach is very mainstream. I think lots of people would prefer what we're doing. So my argument is, I think we can capture real market share and build a very big company out of it,
mm-hmm.
independent of anyone acquiring us or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the goal.
That's cool. So at some point in some future time, you've got 20, 30, 40% of the market. And, you know, it's like, hey, you know, when they're having a panel with Google, they got to get DuckDuckGo to come hang out too.
Well, I'm not going to go so much on the audacity to claim 20, 30%. The first goal is 1%, right? But I think this approach this hybrid approach could get up to a 10% kind of level, something like that.
Since I work for Microsoft, although Microsoft is not affiliated with this podcast, when Bing came out, I was like, you know, kind of obligated to give it a try. And I think it's really pretty, and I like it as my startup page. But maybe, I don't know, 30, 40% of the time, I don't find what I want, and then I go and Google for it. And I call that Googling with Bing. So I'll go and I'll, I don't know, Bingle for something or whatever the hell they call it, and then I'll Google for it. How often when you're using your own product do you search for something and then you go, where is that? I know that that link is there. Where is that? And then how do you solve that problem?
So we have abilities to get to Google pretty quickly. We have this thing called Bang commands where you can add exclamation point anything and go to that site. So you can add to the end of your search exclamation point G and go to Google, or A and go to Amazon, and there's about 1,000 of these. I pretty much use DuckDuckGo exclusively. Occasionally I will try stuff if I run out of stuff in Google or Bing. And actually, if we run out of results, we have a link directly to Google and Bing. You can try it yourself. Okay. We encourage you to try it. I generally don't find, if I run out of results here, I generally don't find it anywhere else either. But there are definitely edge cases where we just totally screw up, in which case other times other search engines will do a better job, you know, and vice versa.
And then how do you solve that, though? As the guy who owns the company, do you say, well, what is it algorithmically that caused us to not get that? Or do you ever go hunt that down and say, guys, go figure out why this link isn't something we know about?
Exactly. I do that all the time. And we encourage feedback. And so there's a link in the bottom right of each page. And it's also on the menu at the top to give feedback. And so we get tons of feedback. And I'm constantly chasing down these cases to try to, you know, improve it.
I like this idea of the Bang thing. It's interesting. It doesn't seem advertised. I guess it's deep in goodies on your homepage, right? But I can type in, you know, myself and then get, say, exclamation point G and go to Google if it didn't work, which means I could keep DuckDuckGo as my homepage and still have access to now three search engines without a lot of extra clicking or typing.
Yeah, and what's great is besides other search engines, you can get to all these other sites that you want to generally go to and search, not through a search engine. So like I use Amazon all the time. Mm-hmm. Some people have learned just to type in Amazon something in a search engine, but I find it much better to go directly to Amazon and search. Generally, it takes longer if you're just on Google to do that. But with the Bang commands, you can just put exclamation A and do the search, and it'll do the exact search for you on Amazon. And so it actually saves you time. So I use that, and then I use a bunch of programming ones because there's tons of programming ones in there. So I do Perl a lot. So I do like CPAN, and I use, you know, like CSS and that kind of stuff.
Interesting. And this is different than typing in Amazon. Like I do that sometimes. I'll type in Amazon plus the thing I'm searching for. That doesn't tell Google necessarily to go search for that. It just adds Amazon into the keyword list. Well, this seems much more targeted.
Exactly. The other one is suboptimal in a number of ways, but it's actually faster if you had to go to Amazon and then find the search box. But with the Bang command, it ends up being faster. And so I think it's a more optimal solution.
Yeah, that is slick. And it looks like you've got hundreds of these things, and there's a drop-down that'll let you get to them.
Basically, any big site, we probably have it. And then we have tons of other ones, tons of programming-related, tech-related ones.
And is it all word of mouth? I mean, how's my mom going to learn about DuckDuckGo other than me telling her?
We've grown mainly through word of mouth. We've had some decent press. Like, we were named one of Time's Best 50 Websites earlier this year.
Nice.
Over 2011, and so that gave some press. I actually bought a billboard in San Francisco on around privacy that said Google tracks you, we don't. That also brought in some users. But yeah, that's an open question.
Well, this is pretty amazing stuff, and people can check out your blog at GabrielWeinberg.com, and you've got like lots of really interesting posts. And if they just go to GabrielWeinberg.com, they'll be able to see, you know, information about you where they can follow you on Twitter. And DuckDuckGo also has a short URL, right? Isn't that ddg.gg?
Yep.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you much for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.